Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos, and today on The Breakdown, she's represented Oakland in the House of Representatives for 22 years. Barbara Lee of Oakland will join us to talk about tonight's debate and more.
And I'm sure we'll chat with her about fellow Oaklander Kamala Harris as well. But first, oh boy, it is the most expensive ballot measure in campaign state history in terms of campaigns. More than $200 million has been spent on Proposition 22, mostly in favor of it. The measure is pitting gig economy companies like Uber and Lyft against organized labor and others. And joining us at the top of the show today, someone who is covering Silicon Valley and labor issues, KQED's Sam Harnett. He's on top of the Prop 22 story. Sam, welcome to The Breakdown.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's talk about Prop 22 put on the ballot by three tech companies, basically would exempt them from a new state law, AB 5, that would require their drivers and delivery people to be classified as employees rather than independent contractors, which they claim they are. So why do they feel so strongly about this?
I mean, for the gig companies, this is existential. I mean, they've built their business model on classifying their workers as contractors, which means they don't have to pay for basic employee protections like workers' compensation and unemployment or overtime if a worker works more than 40 hours. So this is essential for them. And they've been fighting this since day one. I mean, since Uber and Lyft hit the road in 2012, they have been fighting aggressively to continue classifying workers as contractors. Now, over the years, that's gotten harder. The California Supreme Court in 2018 issued the Dynamex decision, which made it harder for companies to classify workers as contractors. The state legislature then passed AB 5, which was directly targeting gig companies. And then earlier this year, the attorney general sued them over this issue. So, yeah, they're fighting tooth and nail. That's why they've spent almost $200 million on this campaign.
So, Sam, I mean, you say this is their business model. My understanding, though, is that these companies aren't actually profitable anyway. Can you talk about what it would mean for workers and the companies if this fails? Like, how what would be the real life impact?
Right. You point out, make a very good point, Marisa. Like, they're not making money anyway. And if they have to make their workers employees, they're going to have even less revenue. That being said, these companies have billions of dollars. Part of their business model all along has been to undercut taxis and to be competitive with public transportation. So they've kept their rates artificially low. Now, if workers had to become employees, certainly the companies would have to do some rejiggering internally. They might have to do things like the most casual workers on the platform. There might be more requirements, so it might be a little more difficult for them. But the bulk of the work on these apps is done by people doing 20, 30, 40 hours of work. And these workers then would get those benefits, which, you know, maybe the companies would have to raise their prices a little bit. You know, maybe they would have to narrow their focus and target certain markets where they could make money. But, you know, Uber and Lyft especially, they've said they'd leave California temporarily over this. But you can imagine they'd figure out some way to stick around.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a huge market. Sam, I know you've spent a lot of time, not just recently, but over the years, talking with drivers. And, you know, there's the fundamental argument of the current system provides independence and flexibility. On the other hand, Prop 22, if it goes down, would give benefits and certain protections to workers. What is your sense of what drivers think and say about this?
You know, it's funny. There's a lot of talk about this. And if you listen to the gig companies, they say, listen, in all these surveys, drivers are saying they want to be independent contractors. And that's technically true. On surveys, drivers do often say they want to be contractors or they want to be have flexibility and have freedom. But really, when you talk to drivers, what they want, it's a little more nuanced than that. They want autonomy and flexibility and independence, but they also want to make enough money so that they can pay for health insurance, so that they can have a replacement for workers' compensation, so that they can actually choose to drive when they want to drive, as opposed to feeling like they have to drive 40, 50, 60 hours just to pay the bills. And back in the beginning of Uber and Lyft, the companies were using their vast amounts of venture capital to subsidize the wages of drivers, so they were higher. But over the last 8 years, rates for Uber, Lyft, and all the other gig companies have gone down and down and down for drivers. So now drivers are saying, listen, you know, we want to be contractors, but we're not getting nearly enough money. And because of how the apps work, you know, the apps incentivize drivers to drive at a certain time. Apps will deactivate drivers if they don't... if they're not rated highly by passengers. They're saying, we're being treated like employees. We're not getting any of the benefits that you or protections you get as an employee, and we're not making enough to live as a contractor. So to sum it all up, what they really want is they want to be independent contractors, but they want to have enough money and protections so that they can really be their own bosses.
And I mean, the actual ballot measure says they'll get 120% of minimum wage, but only for the times they're actually driving, right? Which raises a lot of questions.
Right. We should actually talk about that just for a second, because I think that's really, what Proposition 22 isn't, it doesn't allow them to continue being independent contractors. It sort of creates a new category of worker, a gig contract worker. And it would basically enshrine into law this category, which for now it would be restricted to app-based transportation and delivery services. But you can see there are a lot of other companies that if this passes, you could bet they're going to look at this and say, okay, we should develop an app to get to this new category of worker because it's a lot cheaper than employee status. And Marisa, as you pointed out, a lot of those benefits, we could talk more specifically, but a lot of those benefits are not exactly what they seem.
Right. And I mean, there's also like questions about during the pandemic, about, you know, workers' comp and unemployment. But before we get, we only have a few minutes left with you. I want to ask you about the story you broke this week around what the Uber and Lyft in specific, and I think a couple other companies have been doing almost to pressure drivers into supporting this. Tell us about the text message you got and what you found out.
Right. So I got a message from a driver. It sent me a screenshot from the Uber app. And the screenshot was of a pop-up that driver and other drivers are getting. And the pop-up says, Proposition 22 is progress. And then it has some promotional language about Prop 22. And then a driver has the option to click yes on Prop 22 or okay. Those are the only two options to get rid of this pop-up. Now, this driver wants to be an employee. He actually had gotten into an accident years ago, had to take 8 months off driving and wasn't covered by workers' comp. And that's when he decided, hey, I need employee protections. But now he's getting this app, this pop-up where he has to say either yes on Prop 22 or okay. And he was feeling like I'm being compelled politically to say that I support something I don't support. At the same time, riders in Ubers were getting pop-ups saying your driver support Prop 22, you should talk to them about it. So Uber, Lyft, and these companies are using their apps aggressively to message directly to both the workers and the consumers. And it's something unprecedented in California politics that these companies have so much connection. And the last thing I'll say about that, is there's a lawsuit right now. Uber drivers today, they're suing the company saying that they're being coerced politically on the job.
Yeah. Sam, we're going to let you go in a second, but one last question. You know, you've done a lot of reporting on, you know, how workers have generally, in other industries as well, seen their power and leverage diminish over the past few years, unions weakening also. How do you see this issue, this classification of gig workers, fitting in with that larger trend?
Oh, I think it's huge. I mean, I think that the gig worker category is what American corporations wanted for a long time for workers. I mean, it keeps them at an arm's length. The companies are not responsible. And it's done under the guise of entrepreneurship and being your own boss, which sounds really great. I mean, who doesn't want that? But when you're not making enough money to cover your basic needs, and when the apps actually do have some, they do have these sort of techniques to make you do what the app wants you to do, you're really not in a great position. So I think it's a big continuation of that. And I think with Prop 22, what happens with this prop is going to be a huge decider in how this plays out.
All right. That's KQED Sam Harnett, who covers Silicon Valley and labor issues. Sam, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by a woman who will be keeping a close eye on tonight's presidential debate, Oakland Congresswoman Barbara Lee. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos, and we're now thrilled to have back with us again the woman who has represented Oakland in the House of Representatives since 1998, Barbara Lee. Welcome back to Political Breakdown. Good to have you.
Thank you so much. Really happy to be with you.
Well, I want to ask you about Prop 22, which we were just chatting with Sam Harnett about. You know, the NAACP in California is supporting Prop 22, and it's also taken positions on some other ballot measures. It's opposing rent control. It's opposing bail reform. It's opposing Prop 15, which would generate a lot of money for schools. And, you know, some people feel like that doesn't really represent the best interests of people of color. And I'm just wondering, what do you think of that?
Well, the NAACP has their process upon which they make these decisions. But I just have to tell you, for example, I'm totally opposed to Proposition 22 because I think that drivers need to be treated fairly, and they're not treated fairly. I think it's what, Prop 25 to end cash bail. We've got to do that because it disproportionately affects low income people, people who can't afford that. And so that is a measure that will begin to help address the inequities in this whole criminal supposedly justice system. And so again, I have an advisory committee. My advisory committee conducts due diligence. We talk, we discuss the issues, how what we should do in terms of letting the public know what we think about those issues. Every organization does that. Some I agree with, others I don't.
Well, I mean, I just want to ask you if you think that having the head of, you know, an organization who's taking, I mean, she's, her consulting firm has taken in over $1 million from, you know, the same side of campaigns that then the NAACP weighed in on, does that diminish the importance of their endorsement or should it in the eyes of voters?
Look, I'm sure that the process, whatever the process the NAACP conducts for a position was adhered to. And I'm not sure what that process is. So I can't say whether or not the process was subverted. I have no idea. And I don't think it's my job to really comment on it. I can comment on what positions I've taken and why.
Fair enough. Okay, well, let's move on to the presidential stuff. Joe Biden, of course, has been consistently ahead in national polls. He's even ahead in some swing states, although by smaller margins. And he's even competitive in states like Iowa, Georgia, Ohio, your native Texas even. But, you know, a lot of Democrats are very nervous. I think they still have PTSD from 2016. What about you?
Listen, I know... In terms of what the polls are saying, I'm happy to see what the polls are saying, but in many ways, we know that there are other issues that we need to look at. And so, yes, the polls may say one thing, but I want to make sure that all of our votes are cast and counted. And so we can't take anything for granted, nor can we believe all of the polls. You know, those polls are conducted in a variety of ways. Their methodologies are different. They sometimes poll one population of people versus another. And so, you know, that's one factor. That's one measurement. But the measurement is how many people we contact, how many people ask for their mail-in ballot, how many people vote, how many people show up to vote, how many people vote early, and to make sure that suppression of our votes are not allowed to happen. And that, I think, is extremely important. So I'm not taking anything for granted. I don't know many Democrats who are taking anything for granted. I know the Biden-Harris campaign is not, and I think that's why you see long lines in communities that really recognize that their vote must be cast, their voice must be heard, and they must be counted.
Well, Congresswoman, I know you just were on the ground in Arizona, one of these key swing states that, you know, 10 years ago would have been an easy red win and is really changing. What's your sense on the ground? I mean, what are you hearing, particularly from voters of color, younger voters, who really are those key demographics that the Biden-Harris campaign is really targeting?
Sure. You know, my late mother lived in Arizona for years, and I know Arizona fairly well. And there's no way I would have thought that we would be this close to winning in Arizona. But I have to tell you, the fact that we have so many now people of color who have moved to Arizona, it's my understanding that the census will show that probably now Arizona has close to 10% African-American population scattered, but there. And so I think that we have a very good shot in Arizona. Young people are excited. I visited an African-American church, met with members of the clergy, visited the headquarters. It's a phenomenal team that's working there. They have a good ground campaign, especially in the era of COVID. The health protocols, I have to say, are very, very tight in terms of the social and physical distancing, the wearing of masks, the not concentrating in large crowds. I think, you know, generally, especially in Arizona, we try to build large crowds. Well, in this instance, it's keeping people from coming to build large crowds at the campaign headquarters. I think we could only have about 30 or 35. So the enthusiasm is there. More people want to engage in the ground effort. And so we're doing work virtually. We're doing literature drops, phone banking, texting. And I have a lot of hope. My mother, for example, lived in a part of in Sun City, right outside of the outside of the urban area of Arizona. Sun City looks like it's blue now, and it wasn't before. Huh. But these are seniors who live there who know that Donald Trump, due to his lack of leadership, is responsible for now, what do we have, over 225,000 deaths? Come on. So I think people in Arizona recognize that we've got to crush this pandemic, that seniors are being hit in disproportionate numbers, and that there's a huge stake in this election because it is a matter of life and death, and I think Arizonans really recognize that.
I want to ask you about kind of the role you played 4 years ago when Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton supporters were really at odds with each other. You played the peacemaker. You helped close the gap, and with mixed results, I think I would say, not just because of you, but just because of the animosity there. But how different is the Democratic coalition this time around?
I think the Democratic coalition this time around is very solid. And I think that's a real testament to Vice President Biden and to Senator Bernie Sanders and to Senator Harris. Because as you remember, I endorsed Senator Harris early. And then after Bernie dropped out, I endorsed Senator Biden. And what they did was put together task forces, Vice President Biden, and Senator Sanders. And these task forces came together on the policy agenda. Remember, this is about public policy and about changing the direction of this country. And they presented a consensus recommendation from each task force: healthcare, climate change, jobs, all of the issues that are incorporated in the Democratic Party platform. Now, I was on the drafting committee. There were about, I think, 15 or 16 of us that drafted this Democratic Party platform. I was on it also in 2016 and in 2012. And I can say very clearly that this is the most progressive and the most inclusive platform that I have ever seen. And no one ever reads the Democratic platform, but I would hope that people read it, because this, and I'm going to insist that this be a roadmap that the White House, the president and vice president, look at criminal justice reform. It's a very, very transformational plank in our platform. And so I think that this time around, just looking at the platform in itself, it was progressive in 2016 in terms of making sure that some of the issues that we wanted in were incorporated. But this time, I think Senator Sanders has made a major, major impact. And I helped negotiate those provisions of this platform this time also. And so I think that that in itself brought more consensus, more so than in 2016. But we still have people who are still not quite decided, and those, but most people are decided. But I'm doing everything I can do to make sure that our young people, especially our young people of color, understand that this is about their future and that they must vote. And their vote and their voice definitely is counted. And the Democratic Party platform shows that and demonstrates that in words, and will be activated in the White House in deeds.
Yeah, I want to talk about that because, I mean, one thing we've seen during this general campaign is a real, I think, you know, Biden holding at arm's length some of the issues that Bernie Sanders did champion, the Green New Deal, Medicare for all, you know, really talking about a public option. But quite frankly, being a little bit more moderate on these things. And I'm wondering if you, obviously there's a political reason behind that, but do you ever get concerned that the Democrats are going too far and maybe not be exciting those younger voters you're talking about who largely did support these more, as you know, Trump would say, radical ideas?
Well, I think that these are ideas that are mainstream ideas, really. If you talk about, for instance, a minimum wage of $15 an hour. Come on, we need a living wage. But the Sanders and Biden people agreed to the $15. When you look at the position in the Democratic Party platform on climate, it may not say Green New Deal, but if you read it, it's Green New Deal. In many ways, it incorporates many of the provisions of a Green New Deal. Of course, I support Medicare for all, but that is not in the platform, but we were able to get an agreement to reduce the age for Medicare, and we're gonna continue to work. So nothing's perfect. It's not 100%, and as a progressive, trust me, on day one, I'm gonna be pushing the envelope so that we can make sure that those big ideas and that those progressive ideas of racial justice, racial equity, criminal justice reform, economic growth, green new green jobs, you know, all of the issues that the California Democratic Party platform, which I'm really proud of because I was on that platform committee also, that we pushed the envelope. Because yeah. I think with Vice President Biden and Senator Harris and Senator Sanders, Senator Warren, myself and others, I think we have a seat at the table, and I think that's the right way to conduct business and to conduct our government in a democracy, because not everyone is going to get 100%.
You're listening to Political Breakdown. If you're just joining us, I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos, and we're talking with East Bay Congresswoman Barbara Lee. And of course, everything you just said, Congresswoman, or a lot of it anyway, depends on Democrats taking over the Senate. We'll see if that happens. But, you know, some polls have shown that Trump is doing a little better than Hillary Clinton did with Black and Latinx voters, which, you know, would seem to be counterintuitive. What do you make of that?
You know, that's hard to understand. First of all, this 45th president in the White House, Donald Trump, has done just the opposite for the African-American and Latinx community. When you look, for example, at taking children, snatching children from their families at the borders, right now there are 500 and some children. We don't know where their parents are because of Donald Trump, because of what he has done. When you look at the African-American community and what he has done in terms of, and I'm going to just give you a couple of examples. I serve on the Appropriations Committee, coming forth with zero money for addressing health disparities in the minority communities, rolling back civil rights offices within the Department of Education and other agencies, issuing executive orders that stop racial inclusion and diversity and unconscious bias programs, taking the side of white supremacists. You know, it's amazing that anyone can condone these policies in this country especially African Americans and Latinx communities. So I don't believe that that people of color are going to vote for Donald Trump if they look at their record and if they look at what he has not just not done, but how he has reversed the clock, housing discrimination. They've dismantled policies that address housing discrimination. When you look at what he's doing with healthcare, healthcare is a big issue for African Americans and for the Asian Pacific Asian American and Pacific Islander community and for the Latinx community. Here, this man has begun to dismantle the Affordable Care Act and has filed a lawsuit that's going to be before the Supreme Court November 10th to take away health care from millions of people. Guess who that health care will be taken away from? The most vulnerable, from women, from Black and brown people. And so if African Americans and Latinx community look at his record and see what he not only has not done, but is doing to set us back and to take away our lives in a lot of ways in terms of health care, then that to me is enough to say no way.
All right.
We can't.
Congresswoman, I want to ask you, if Democrats win and Kamala Harris is our next vice president, we will have an open Senate seat here in California. Governor Gavin Newsom will get to choose her replacement. What should he be looking at for a replacement? Maybe someone like you, perhaps?
Yeah, I'm focused very clearly on November 3rd, and we've got to win this election. Well, we've got to make sure that Senator Harris is our vice president and that Joe Biden is our president. That's my response to that.
Shortest answer we've gotten all day.
Yeah, exactly. Boy, well, we made you laugh anyway. That's interesting. But seriously, what kind of person do you think? Like, not who, but what kind?
Man, that's up for the governor. You know, the governor's very smart. He's strategic. He knows what the state needs in the Senate. And he will make his decision based on his criteria and based on what he thinks the state needs and how effective someone would be on behalf of the state in the state Senate. So he's going to make that decision.
So just a couple of minutes left, Congresswoman. Tell us tonight, we're a few hours away from the final presidential debate. What does a win look like for Joe Biden?
Well, you know, almost what I said about Senator Harris and her debate is being himself. He's very authentic. He connects with people, and I think speaking directly to the American people about, he feels their pain and he knows what they're going through, but also what he's going to do to, one, crush this pandemic, as Speaker Pelosi says, because, you know, too many people have died due to the lack of leadership. Too many people are, today I saw something that said, what, 1,100 deaths, the highest death rate as it relates to COVID since the pandemic began. I mean, this is serious. And so I hope he talks about his commitment to take leadership in helping to address the COVID pandemic in a way that we have not seen yet. Secondly, I hope he talks about the economic impact of not only what has happened, but what he will do to bring people back to work, to help our small businesses, to move the economy forward, because this, and he understands this is a health and economic crisis. I was in Congress when he was vice president, and I saw how he pushed that recovery bill forward to make sure that this country did not fall into a deep depression.
So all right, we're going to have to leave it there. We're going to have to leave it there. We're going to be watching along with you. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thanks a million.
All right. That's it for this edition of Political Breakdown. It's a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati. Our engineer is Katie McMurrin. KQED's team includes Holly Kernan, Ethan Tovin Lindsay, Vinnie Tong, Erica Aguilar, and Jonathan Blakely. I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at @MLagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @ScottSchaefer. Thanks so much for listening.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.